July by Shoreside Theatre's production of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, happening at the Pump House. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show, brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz or find us on Spotify. On the show tonight, we're talking music, theatre and books, so it is a busy show. However, to start the show, we wish to acknowledge the passing of Kiwi icon Christopher Fawemua, known as Moo, the founder of Fat Freddy's Drop, one of Aotearoa's most successful contemporary bands, which was formed in 1999 and blended a wide range, or blends I should say, a wide range of music genres, including reggae, soul, jazz, rhythm, blues, rock, disco, in-house. So to kick off, here is Pull the Catch from their 2009 album Dr. Boo Digger and the Big BW.
As one, pull the catch as one. We need your food for everyone. Pull the catch as one. Pull these cats together. Yeah, there's nothing that I would not do. My family, this blood is thick, it sticks like glue, yes, but through these veins it flows with ease. Now I could never ask for help, for so many times I've tried it, but we learn ourselves. Now I, yeah, ready, come pull the catch as one. Pull the catch as one. Ready, your food for everyone. Pull the catch as one. Pull these cats together. Come pull these cats together. Yeah, yeah. We'll be right back. to one. Pull the catch as one.
And that was Fat Freddy's Drop. Now, Stephen, I'm sure you have had a number of summers and things road tripping to Fat Freddy's.
Absolutely, although I did think tonight you would be playing Coldplay.
Oh, really? And why would that be?
Well, the internet sensation of the couple having the affair at the Coldplay concert, and I think he's lost his job now. Isn't it been so over every bit of Instagram you can find?
Well, that will serve someone right for not thinking about the fact there might be a live camera.
I know, it's brilliant. Comedian Dom Jolly, I don't know if you remember him from the TV series Trigger Happy, and they used to do like those candid camera shows, and he just came out saying that, you know, on average they would do filming somewhere like in movie cinemas and things, and because it was all infrared cameras, and then at the end they had to get everyone's declaration. They'd average 12 couples a night that were having affairs that wouldn't sign the paperwork.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy.
Anyway, how are you?
I'm good. How is Tauranga?
Tauranga is beautiful and sunny today. We've had a fabulous big rehearsal day down here in the sort of 4 and a bit weeks to go as we sort of head down the path towards Jersey Boys opening. But it's been good, and we closed Lightning Thief last night in Auckland, so it's been a busy old week.
It sounds like it has been, and I haven't caught up with any shows this week, but I have to say I have been busy, both with a national meeting for Musical Theatre New Zealand, which was strat planning, etc., and that was down hosted by the Meteor down in Hamilton. And then today, as part of the 40 years of Drama New Zealand, I spent part of the day with the Auckland branch at a bit of a celebration, but also some workshops. And I did a fabulous masterclass with Jennifer Ward-Leyland this morning on intimacy coordination.
Oh, that's brilliant. You've had a busy week. I love that Meteor venue in Hamilton.
It's great.
You come in and it's like an art gallery and then into a theatre space. And it's really cool.
And it's got a fantastic, I didn't realise, I've been in the theatre space before, but discovered the hot desk space upstairs is actually quite substantial. But they've also got an amazingly big-sized rehearsal room upstairs as well.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Now, I did manage to catch some shows since we last caught up. Into the Woods, our friends at the Playhouse Theatre had that running. I think you managed to catch that as well. And Merrily We Roll at Auckland Music Theatre. And what a fabulous night out that was.
Yeah, and I mean, it was one of those shows that I remember when we interviewed them, you didn't really know the music as such, but there was definitely some numbers in there, I'm sure, when they started singing that. You were like, oh, that song comes from here.
But I am glad they told us in the interview that the show worked sort of the backwards timeline. That was actually quite an advantage, I felt, to know that.
Yeah, I think if I'd gone and sat down, I might have been questioning what was going on, because,
Massive credit to the band. It was a good sound.
It was fantastic. And I suppose the other thing we need to say too is I believe that someone had a major milestone birthday this week.
Oh, we're trying to avoid having those conversations here.
Well, I don't know. I think our Kick-Arts listeners should hear that you hit that half a century mark. Oh, did I just say which milestone it was out loud? How rude of me.
Yes, well and truly. But it was a quiet night had with family, but it was nice celebration nevertheless.
Beautiful. So what's this week looking like for you, I should say?
Well, school holidays are finished, of course. Everyone's back to routines. For me, it's starting to think about the show you and I have coming up in the September-October holidays. We've also got our Danza Showcase coming up. And then it's sort of the post-show with Lightning Thief and all the rap stuff you've got to do on that. So yeah, it's more thinking ahead to the term ahead. What about you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Obviously, I was back at school last week, and it's a bit of craziness coming up this coming weekend. I'm adjudicating a competition. I'm supporting my own students in a competition. And then the following weekend, actually, is Junior Theatre Celebration Melbourne. So, yeah, lots going on.
Lots happening. And a big shout-out to all our lovely guests and guest hosts that have been helping you out along the way, but I understand you're one down tonight.
I am one down tonight. I did think we were going to have Adam tonight, but he's sick. But he's told me that he's managed to move his roster and he will be here next week. So tonight I'm trying to get through. My aim is to get it right tonight. So brilliant. I'm going to jump, though, over shortly. We're going to wrap you up because I've got my first guest sitting here waiting.
Fantastic. Take it away with them. Make sure you kick some arts and have a fabulous show.
Great. And we'll catch up during the week.
Cool. Take care, team.
Thanks. Wow. So it's definitely quite an interesting time being here, as our listeners know, on my own. Well, I'm not on my own, though, because I have guests in the studio. So we're going to jump over that way and let's talk about something that's coming up at the Basement Theatre. So, kia ora, team, Josiah and Alisa.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
So, tell us, first of all, you've only just arrived in Tamaki Makaurau. So, what have you brought to our end of the country?
We are bringing a production of William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar that runs 75 minutes and the whole play is performed by just two actors on a traverse staging.
Wow. So, who had the task of cutting it down from probably, I suppose, original Julius Caesar's about 3.5 to 4 hours normally?
That's
to
right.
75 minutes.
Yeah. We did that together. It took us a lot of negotiating over about 6 weeks, I would say. Initially, we cut it to a version that was about 100 minutes. And for this version, we've cut that down further to a 70, 75-minute run.
Wow, that's absolutely crazy, because I suppose within that 75 minutes, are there costume changes or is it all just done through acting changes?
It's all physicality and kind of building a theatrical world, a believable world just with bodies, single costumes. There's a very, very slight amount of props and a little bit of audio that kind of helps us along. But it's pretty much just the empty stage and the actors' bodies. Yeah.
Crazy. So when you were doing the cuts, how much of the cuts were kind of done on the floor? What would this look like if we did this, 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 in comparison to a pencil on paper going, oh, I don't need to say that?
It was a bit of both. It started over that six-week period with Alisa and I sitting down, and then we got into the rehearsal room and we realised we had to bring some stuff back in. We had to lose a bunch of stuff. Do you want to talk about that a bit more, Alisa?
So first few read-throughs that we did were like, ooh, you know, this is great and all Shakespeare, but we can probably get away without saying that. I would say we did probably only about 70% of the cuts pen on paper, and then once we got into the rehearsal room, we'd be doing a scene, we're like, oh, we're suddenly referencing something that we thought we didn't need. Turns out he was onto something. Probably the last 30% of the cuts happened in rehearsal.
And then there's another thing that happened. So we performed this original 90-minute cut in Ōtautahi, North Canterbury and Dunedin. And when we toured the show to Dunedin, we also performed in high schools. And that meant that we had to fit the act breaks. So in Auckland, we're performing just one act with no interval. But the version that we toured to Dunedin was an hour and a half with a 15-minute interval in the middle of the show. And we had to suddenly fit the parameters of Act 1 and Act 2 to fit within a school period. And so over that period, we found ourselves learning how to cut bits of the show just on the fly. We'd look at the clock and we'd be like, right, we've got about 10 minutes left in Act 1. And where do we go next? So we have a really flexible and really kind of keyed in on-stage listening presence with each other now. But this 75-minute version has been kind of taking some of those learnings from the Dunedin season and putting them into action for a one-act pace.
Fantastic. And how much of it is, is it in a different context because it is only 75 minutes, or is it fairly, I'm going to action, inverted commas.
It's It's pretty much traditional Shakespeare. Pretty mm-hmm. much traditional Shakespeare, pretty much set in traditional Rome. It has this kind of unusual framing in that we acknowledge the theatrical convention the whole way along. So it kind of takes place in a slightly Brechtian reality. It doesn't lean too far in that direction. It's just enough of a light touch that the audience can see what the production parameters are. One of the reasons that we did the show, made the decision to do the show with just two actors, was because a lot of the actual material that Shakespeare talks about is about division and mirroring and being two sides of the same coin. And as we started to uncover that and unpack that a little bit more, we realized that this show might be a really great way to talk about how difficult it is for independent artists to make expensive, large-budget, large-cast shows in New Zealand. And so we started to ask the question, what would it look like if we performed a show that, in theory, needs to be done with a really big cast, and we just took the large cast away because this is the way that we could pay everyone to be involved fairly?
Mm. I mean, I directed Ugly Shakespeare Company for 2 years.
Yeah, great.
A number of years ago, but which is a similar kind of thing. But the difference with them is, of course, because they are only a schools tour. Now, when they first started, they did night shows and things as well. Making it accessible to students means they still have huge chunks of traditional Shakespeare, but then they do the modernisation so that the kids get it.
Yeah.
Do you find that the kids get it, especially given that you are doing switching in character and all those kind of things?
I have never done a more thrilling performance than I have to doing Julius Caesar in front of 400 teenage boys at an all-boys school. It was like that first 15 minutes of, oh, is this working? Very scary, but we sort of felt like we'd nailed it when at interval time a bunch of the boys were like, this is punk rock. Like, literally, that was their words.
One of the best reviews I've had from a teenager.
Yeah.
So, tell us, where did you guys meet? How did you become a working...
So we met in Christchurch when we were working on another play together, a version of Philip Ridley's Radiant Vermin, which is another, basically, two-handed play. And then I got this excellent text from Josiah, I want to say a couple of months after we finished, because we knew, great to work together again. And then I open my phone one day and it starts with, I've got an idea, you're going to think I'm crazy, we should do a Shakespeare play, but with two of us. And I absolutely did think he was crazy, and I still do to a little degree, but it was a good idea, didn't lead me astray, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
Our working relationship definitely developed through Radiant Vermin in terms of seeing and understanding that both of us are really interested in difficulty, and I found that really appealing about Elisa, that everything that was difficult or tricky in that play was the stuff that we leaned into exploring. And so we're sort of on this perpetual pathway now of finding the next most difficult thing to do.
How do we top that?
Exactly.
How do we raise the stakes more? How do we up the challenge?
If we thought that Julius Caesar in 90 minutes was difficult, what about Julius Caesar in 75?
Well, and what about taking a 75-minute show around and touring it? So, like, let's throw touring into the mix and going into a school where you probably have an hour to set up, be organised, mm-hmm. do the show, half an hour to get out of the school grounds,
yep.
and then go to another school yep. maybe.
Yeah,
it's been a really fascinating part of the show as well, is that when we were developing it, we were really interested in not having to find spaces that worked for the show, but how could we adapt our show for different spaces around the country.
Yeah, because you kind of walk into a space and you kind of have to walk around and go, oh, okay, do we need to switch sides? Is there a site, actually, that would suit better if we turned it around?
It's one of the first things that we do every time we walk into a new room, is we're like, which one of us gets which side of the room? Because each of us as actors on stage in this version kind of has an area of the stage that is sort of our territory, mm-hmm. if you put that in quote marks. So that's one of the first decisions we have to make in every new room.
But having two of you must make the touring side easier/cheaper?
Yes.
Yes.
So one of the things we're really interested in doing with this show is kind of breaking down what the actual financial logistics of being an independent artist in New Zealand are. So in Christchurch, we were funded by Creative Communities and the Christchurch City Council's Toi o Totahi strategy. And we had some kind of mentorship support from them as well. And then in Dunedin, we were funded specifically to go into schools. So we used the schools tour as a way of assisting us to tour to the Dunedin Fringe. And then we've had in-kind venue support in Auckland and North Canterbury. And then one of the things that we've found with this particular show is that because it's so small scale in terms of what happens on stage, we were able to kind of take the profits from the Ototahi and Dunedin season and put them towards actually getting to the North Island in the first place. And we'll be doing that same thing again in November when we take the show to Brisbane. But we've got a few months between Auckland and Brisbane.
Okay. So what are maybe, Alisa, what's been the biggest challenge, do you think, of this process, whether, you know, the first time you did it or now? What's been the most challenging thing? Like, we've heard that you get excited by the challenge. What's it been?
I think one of the most challenging things is because during the play, I play, depending on the version, between 5 and 9 different characters. While we're up here, I've got 5 characters under my belt, to Josiah's 2. He absolutely has an incredibly hard job. His job might be harder than mine. But I have 5 characters to remember their through lines of the play, remember physicality, voice. Where did I leave that character last time I was them? How do I get back over to where I left them to pick them back up, to switch around again? I think that would be the hardest, keeping track of my 5 people at any given moment during the play.
And what kind of strategies have you come up with for that?
Ooh. Trust my instincts. If my body wants to go where I left, where I didn't think I left a character, it's done this show more than my brain has. Trust it.
Cool. That's a good one to go with, definitely. And what about you? What's your biggest challenge in this?
The biggest challenge that I find during this show is right at this point, it's that sometimes we get a little bit comfortable. You know how that happens when you know a show really well? We're real flexible with it now. And in the rehearsals, sometimes you find you have to really start to trick yourself back into listening again because you know the words so well. Initially, it was genuinely just the sheer quantity of lines. And I mean, that's the thing that like any experienced actor will tell you is the easy part. But this was pretty brutal. This was like 8 weeks of full-time line learning, which I was lucky enough to learn the lines for this show while away on another tour, so I didn't have much going on. I was kind of in rural New Zealand with, you know, 70 pages of Shakespearean text. But just the actual discipline to sit down for 2 hours a day for 6 weeks straight to get this much text was genuinely the most difficult line learning job I've ever done.
And also the fact that you were then coming in and making changes. Like, I'm someone that once I learn lines, I actually find it really hard to unlearn. It's kind of like choreography, right? You learn a dance, and then when the choreographer goes, actually, we're going to change that whole section, it's like, oh, but my body's learnt that.
That's one of the interesting things this time, is that sometimes in the middle of a run of the 75-minute version, we'll kind of catch ourselves saying things that are part of the longer version, and it all works out in the end. We're kind of good enough now at balancing out when those things pop up. But it is an interesting one to notice your brain already moving down a track.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, still having to make sure when we're in the middle of a monologue, I'm like, I really want to say that next couplet, but I can't because we've only got 75 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. So how much of the Shakespeare's form have you kind of had to, because you know how, you know, it's X amount of lines and X amount of rhymes, and
we've been pretty close to the staying in Shakespeare's world. We've not lost any of the form of the language. We might have lost certain lines here or there, but we've been very true to the iambic pentameter, to the lines that need to exist. We haven't mangled that too much.
Yeah, all of Shakespeare's play, all of Julius Caesar is written in iambic pentameter, not prose, so it's not one of the plays that uses a mix between the different kind of classes or different types of characters. So we've maintained the iambic pentameter the whole way through, and so in moments where a decision had to be made around whether something would be said or not, sometimes a deciding factor was whether we could lean into the form and maintain that. There's one tiny wee moment where we cheat that a little bit, but I think that's fun and quite clear to the audience when it happens. I don't want to spoil it.
No, that's fine. So tell me, was Shakespeare something that was a passion prior to this?
I've always enjoyed it. I wouldn't say it's the passion to every other, over every other area of theatre, because there's so many fascinating areas, but I have definitely leaned into it over the last, 18 months now, I think, that we've been working on this show. Yeah, and it's really, really exciting to just have the opportunity to kind of languish in the world and the language and the heightened emotion of it all.
Hmm.
Whereas for me, I mean, I would describe myself as someone who was sort of Shakespeare neutral for quite a long time. I'm a writer as well, so I guess I was always interested in him on the page, but I always found the translation to the stage, I don't know, sometimes a little bit naff, sometimes I struggled to connect with it. With a few exceptions, there are a few really great Shakespeare shows that I've seen over the years, and then my relationship to that started to change post-COVID, particularly doing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream in 2022 in Christchurch, where I played Helena, which is a role that Elisa has coincidentally played as well. But this play has been a real turning point for really understanding what it is that makes Shakespeare tick for me. In this play, the cut might feel counterintuitive. I play both Brutus and Cassius, and Elisa plays everyone else. But one of the things that's a little bit strange or interesting, that only an opportunity that was only afforded by performing in this role, was understanding that Brutus and Cassius often use opposite stresses in their iambic pentameter. And when they're arguing with each other, or when they're trying to convince each other of something, often they'll cut each other off midline. And what that means is that they force the opposite person to speak in the opposite iambic pentameter, so that they end up provoking differences in conversation, literally at the level of form. And that's the kind of thing that I don't think you'd pick up if you weren't memorizing.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because I mean, I know that, you know, like Shakespeare's something that I hated at school, but I think I hated it because I had an English teacher that used to make us read around the class. Mm-hmm. So you got really, I shouldn't say bad readers, but you got some readers that
less
were
confident readers,
less confident, yeah, or slow, or didn't understand it. And it made it boring to me because there was no flow.
It makes it an obligation as well, as opposed to something that you want to embrace.
Mm. Whereas I had a drama teacher who did a Shakespeare every second year that were glorious. But because I didn't like Shakespeare, I never auditioned for them. I used to always get called in to be like one of the singing minstrels on the side. And it actually wasn't until I did a workshop with Jonty at Unitech up here, and he really, really got us into the whole physicalization, you know. But I do think it's something that you either love or you, I was going to say hate, but I don't think people hate Shakespeare.
I think there are audience members that certainly have that feeling. And, like, I think there can be a sense sometimes that Shakespeare is like a little bit of your theatre homework. Like, you go to your Shakespeare during the year. I think that's part of what we've been trying to set out to do with this production, is to go, no, it's not homework. And if it is homework, we're at least making it as hard for us as it is for you.
Yeah.
But part of the show is about making it easy to watch and easy to sit down and easy to follow the narrative.
Bizarrely, even though the format is counterintuitive, we do generally feel like it's a more accessible version than your average 20-person on a stage spouting lines.
Well, part and also standing, listening, or if you're groundling, or sitting for 3.5 hours, like,
that's a long
there's
time
going to be a
brain
time during that you're going to feel yourself. I mean,
oh yeah, you're zoning out.
Yeah.
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 We also have the advantage, I have to give them a shout out. We also have the advantage of our show is scored by music from the DJs Mr. Meaty Boy and Protection Spell. And it's so that's the only thing that isn't really in the Shakespearean kind of Roman world. We have this kind of hard techno music driving the show forward. And I think that really helps punctuate knowing when it's time to start paying attention again and when it's time to really ramp up. Yeah.
That's really cool.
That's
really
awesome.
Cool. Really. So are you going to catch Romeo and Juliet while you're up here?
I was looking at it. We were going to try to, and there's not a single window where we're not performing at the same time or on a flight back home to Christchurch.
How frustrating.
I know. We could have planned that better if we had looked far enough in advance, but
because I've heard that's a very interesting version too. It's a cut-down version.
Great.
Romeo's been stripped back, so I hear. So it's one that I'm definitely looking forward to. So
yeah, I'll be very interested to see the reviews of that. Yeah. I really love Ben's work as well.
Yeah, yeah. So you've just kind of segued into music. Let's have a quick music break. So this is from Millie Moon and the Velvet Isle, and this is called After Winter.
It's been a long time since
Was Millie Moon and the Velvet Isle. So any of you that are wondering where we get our Kiwi music from, one, we love it, absolutely love it when people dob their friends and family in. So if you've got someone out there that you know is creating new music, let us know. Flick us a Facebook message or an Instagram message, or email us at info@kickarts.org.nz. But also, I constantly go to Spotify to New Hatchlings, which is a Kiwi playlist on, I'm not sure who uploads it, but literally new tracks these days are dropped on a Friday. So when I opened it up today, it had a whole lot of tracks that came out 2 days ago. So quite often that's where this music is found from. But like I said, dob people in, let us know. Now we're back to Julius Caesar. And I'm really keen to hear about where your arts journey started. So, Josias, take it away.
My arts journey started, as for many of us it did, when I was five in the school talent quest. But I got swept up pretty quickly from that school talent quest into the world of theatre when the Court Theatre, when I was 6 years old, needed a six-year-old for a production of Carl Nixon's The Raft. So I was exposed to a professional environment really early on and just kind of fell in love with it from there. And I've been involved with the arts ever since, through ballet, through theatre, through writing. I went to university for an English literature degree, an anthropology degree, and a history degree. But since leaving university, I've been freelancing in the arts full time.
So did you do 3 degrees one at a time, or did you do like a co-joint?
Yeah, 1 degree with all of those subjects right. kind of as part of it. I guess Aucklanders would probably know my stuff best from maybe the world of writing. My book, I'm Still Growing, is out on Dead Bird Books, the wonderful Auckland-based publisher. And I was also up here last February with Auckland Pride performing a 6-hour-long performance artwork called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, named after the film of the same title. But I guess like many of us in the arts in New Zealand, I'm working across basically any discipline I can get my hands on because I'm interested in all of it. Yeah.
And it means that you've got regular mahi and Pūtea coming in.
Absolutely. That's also definitely part of the equation, yeah.
So when you think back to your 6-year-old self doing a professional gig, what do you think was your biggest learning at that time? Even if you didn't realise at that time that it was learning then, how do you think that influenced you going forward?
I think that I have high standards in a healthy way. Not like high standards unnecessarily, but I do think that there is something to be said for understanding what a work environment that is professional and values you looks like. That a lot of us don't get the chance to experience through our high school years, potentially after our high school years as well, particularly when working in kind of amateur environments, which is are often amazing places, but also sometimes can accidentally let bits of your well-being kind of fall by the wayside. And I think understanding what it actually looks like to be valued and kind of cared for in these kind of spaces, particularly as a child in a play that was quite not child-friendly. Yeah, to kind of see some of those care processes put in place. I don't really remember much of it now other than Yvonne Martin being really lovely and sitting and doing colouring books with me backstage. Shout out, Yvonne.
Yeah, but that's, that, like you said, it's so important, especially if you're doing content which isn't user-friendly.
Well, the arts is all, you know, like the arts is all relational, and it was, yeah, that's kind of my main memory, is that still some of those relationships and some of those people stand out in memory.
Nice.
Yeah.
Alyssa, where did it begin for you? Not in New Zealand.
Well, off and on. So unlike many people in New Zealand, I'm from a very small town on the west coast called Karamea, and we didn't always have the same performing arts opportunities like talent quests and all that as bigger areas, but I was lucky enough to have a very supportive family who recognised this in me and would take me to the nearby towns where I could do things like singing lessons and I guess nurture that part of me, and then moved to Nelson for high school, got more involved then, and then when I went to university, I really wanted to do a student exchange for the importance of my degree, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But it also let me audition for drama schools in person in the UK, and I ended up doing a year at the Academy of Live and Recorded Arts in London, which was where I did my training. Absolutely fascinating being exposed to arts in different areas of the world. I saw a lot. I had the opportunity to see a lot of plays that we just don't get in the same way in New Zealand. We have amazing local work here, but because distance from everywhere else, we don't get the touring in the same way. We don't just have the depth of being able to go out and see a different play every night. So yeah, that's where I did most of my training. And then when I moved back to New Zealand, I was really, really surprised and impressed at how much the art scene in Ōtautahi has come on in the years that I was away. I was not expecting the sheer amount of opportunities and exciting things that are both coming up from the grassroots in the town but also visiting from around the country. And yeah, I've been really excited and impressed by what I've been able to do down south.
I was going to say, because yeah, down there you've got, you know, like the Buskers Festivals brings in a lot of international, you know, and the new Court Theatre. Have you been to anything there yet, either
I've
of you?
I've been to almost everything. I'm missing Kōpū, which is touring there right now.
So
sadly.
Sad to miss that.
Yeah, but it's a lovely, lovely theatre, lovely building, right next to the beautiful Isaac Theatre Royal, right opposite the beautiful Tauranga Central Library, which is also a lovely kind of venue as well for performance and stuff when you want it to be.
Yeah.
Like, we, and the piano's just around the corner,
the piano's
isn't
just around the corner. Yeah, the town hall's right there. Yeah, it's starting to feel I say starting to feel, it's really feeling alive as of the last kind of 18 months.
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
There's lots of things happening. There's lots of things being created.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's a key too, isn't it? Like you've done, you've gone, right, well, let's create something so that we've got work. Yep. And there are a lot of groups down in your end of the...
Neck of the woods.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like, I'm a, you know... There's Theatre Wise working on things at the moment, which is really good for those people coming out of NASDA to have a company that they can go and do a musical with maybe before they do the court. And I mean, the court only do usually one musical a year.
I mean, I'm also seeing a really interesting relationship starting to emerge, I think, between Ototahi artists and Tamaki Makaurau artists. I'm seeing more and more... sort of exchange opportunities or relationships being built, I guess particularly in the fine art space, but also in the theatre space as well, with some of the independent work like ours that is starting to kind of have a relationship between both cities. Mm. Whereas even 2 or 3 years ago, I guess before Little Andromeda had really taken off, but also some other new venues like the Art Centre now have a lovely little small theatre called The Cloisters. Sometimes you'd just see kind of a North Island tour start to take place, but now we're starting to get a lot of the wonderful stuff that's being made up here as well.
Do you think some of that's as well, though, because we've got the fringe happening? You know, there's Fringe Auckland, Fringe Dunedin, Fringe Christchurch, Fringe, you know, so it does mean you kind of can set yourself up for a bit of a tour?
I think it definitely helps. Interestingly, we don't have a fringe in Christchurch, but we sort of have a perpetual fringe in Christchurch because of Little Andromeda and the kind of seasonal programming. I do think we've got a good...
I should have said Wellington, Fringe
Wellington. Yeah, Wellington. Mm. I do think we've got a lovely kind of independent arts infrastructure now in that we have Basement, we have Bats in Wellington. We do have the Dunedin Fringe who kind of work with a wide range of venues. We've got Little Andromeda in Christchurch, and then there's all of these other kind of regional places as well. One of the things that we've found is that... our audiences are really receptive to finding places for us to go as well. Mm. That's how we ended up touring to North Canterbury, is that one of our audience members saw the show, loved it, had a venue in mind, and then worked with us to actually help get that out to that rural community. So I think that in the sense that you're constantly uncovering new things in Christchurch and building relationships, yeah, it's really interesting to see the scope across the country feel really possible right now, which might be different than sometimes how we talk about the arts, because it is pressurized in New Zealand. But I do think that our size and the tightness of our community and the kind of love that I often see artists showing for each other's work does make it possible to feel like you can go elsewhere. And
it opens different ways of working up.
Yes.
Have you thought about applying or putting yourself forward for... things like, it's not pack-ins, it's...
Pans?
Yes.
Yeah, we've thought about it. We are in the odd position of, we were originally just making this show for a Christchurch audience. We didn't know we were going to tour it. So it was the end of our tour in August, our first season in August in Christchurch, and we looked at the ticket sales, and we looked at the reviews, and we looked at how we felt about it, and we were like, oh...
this might have some legs in
it. Yeah, there was something kind of cool going on there. That
it was resonating with people. And
it felt like a risk when we were in rehearsal, and then as soon as we had an audience, we were like, oh, this definitely works. And so since then, that's how the Fringe kind of application worked out, and the next step is to begin to slowly apply for more international legs, which I won't say too much about right now, just in case.
Cool. But that's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's great that it has got legs, and, you know, that's another way to keep it fresh as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
We learn something new every time we do it in a different environment, actually, because each city has a slightly different kind of audience character, slightly different audience persona.
The atmosphere is mildly different, and that's enough to bring different aspects of the show out that might not have been emphasised in other cities.
Yeah, I mean, the venue does that as well, right? The different building.
The venue's character.
Yeah, I mean, in Dunedin, we performed entirely in natural light in an old hall with stained glass windows. So that kind of created a lighter energy than we did in the dark, blacked-out Christchurch Art Centre Theatre. Yeah.
Very cool. All right, so we're coming to the business end. Who's doing this?
Oh, I've just been elected to do this.
You've been elected, so tell us, where can people find out more about the show? And most importantly, when is it on? And how can people get tickets?
You can find out more information about our production of William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar at the Basement Theatre website. The show is on this Tuesday to Saturday. That's the 22nd to the 26th of July at 6:30 p.m. in the Basement Theatre studio. And you can get tickets through Basement Theatre's website, iTicket, or the Kick Arts events page.
Awesome. Well, all the best. Can't wait to hear where it goes. Maybe get in touch with us once you come back from Brisbane or these other international legs that you've said. But all the best. I hope that it's not a question of to be or not to be, and that it actually all goes swimmingly.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
No worries. Now, we're going to take a quick music break while I get our next guest on the phone. And this is In the Shallows, Do You, featuring Module.
Anymore, sadness comes in waves that are hard to ignore. In between pleasure and sheer determination, I'm still here crying, crying on the bedroom floor.
The Shallows, Do You? And joining us now on the phone from In the Shallows is Danny. Kia ora.
Kia ora, how are you?
We're very good, thank you. Now tell me, where are you phoning in from around the country?
From Paikakariki, actually, in Wellington, just up in the Kapiti Coast.
Beautiful. So tell us a little bit about In the Shallows.
At the moment, we're kind of on a whole new era with the new band. Most of the band are new, aside from my bass player, who's been playing with us for about 5 years. But it was a band that started really as a folk duo. We did have a band in the early days, but mainly just for recording in our Wellington shows, but we weren't touring with them. We were just touring as a duo. And then as time went on, we were starting to do more festival slots and things like that. So I started writing more for those bigger spaces and more for a band. And I spent about 2 years writing, and now that it's coming to releasing the music, it just had to be done with a full band. So it's our first time touring with a full band, and for the show that we're going to be doing in Auckland, we'll also have the string section, the cellist, the violinist, and our harpist as well.
Holy heck. So what's that meant for you as a band in regards to obviously having a full band? How have you gone about finding the money for that?
That's a really good question. No one ever asked that question. And it's something that goes unnoticed, how challenging it is for artists to be able to keep doing what we do. And on this particular tour, we teamed up with as many venues as we could to offer free to access shows, because we know, like, we're really struggling as artists for sure, especially since COVID. And we're finding it that's affecting us now, actually, more than ever, I think, because people are having to be really careful about where they're spending their money. So in order to make this happen for it to be accessible for people, we made the shows, as many of the shows as we could, free to access. It's a little bit tricky in Wellington and Auckland because the overheads are pretty high. And then obviously we're bringing a traveling party of 9 musicians and sound engineer and having to hire a harp and all of those other things. So yeah, it's not easy. I'm an independent musician, so I've been, funding it myself for 7 years.
Mm.
And there are many times where I question how deluded I might be. but then when we do the tours and we do the shows and we get such a great response from the audiences, that makes it all worthwhile. So
you did do a boosted campaign as well though, didn't you?
We did try to do a boosted campaign. Unfortunately, that was not successful.
Annoying.
Yeah, it would have really helped. But yeah. That's okay. Here we are. We're still pushing on anyway, it's definitely challenging for sure. So we really appreciate radio stations like yourself just helping to get the word out there about what we're doing. And then, people who do come along, it means a lot to us. It makes a big difference. It helps us to keep going.
Yeah, well, and it, like you were saying, I think it's not only post-COVID. It's also, when you hear the cost of living crisis and we're paying $10.50 for a block of butter these days. I mean,
I know.
Do we put food, so coming out to a show is, it probably is quite a big decision. Like, do I pay for a ticket or do I, but we need people to pay for tickets because otherwise we can't keep going, right?
We do, and emerging artists won't get a chance to ever get anywhere. I think what we're finding is that people will, especially because during COVID we were kind of deprived of a lot of the international acts, we're finding that people will put the money aside for those, and those shows are still selling pretty well. But the local acts are the ones that are suffering. The $10, $20, $30 shows are the ones that, people are, maybe spending way in advance already on the international show that's coming in 6 months' time. So, it is really tricky, but we also know how hard it is for people, which is why, we did what we did, trying to offer as many free shows as we could. I mean, I saw a post today about butter being $18.
Whoa!
It's pretty wild out there.
It sure is. So tell us a little bit about your process of writing. So you write the music for your band, or do you have someone that helps you? Like, how do you go about, how does In the Shallows do their music?
It's been many different processes in a way. So when we first started the band, it was just Lance Shepherd and myself. Lance isn't in the band anymore. But when we first began, I came with a few songs that I'd written the melody and a basic guitar part to, and Lance would add, he was a very good guitarist, so he would add a more complex guitar part to it. And we ended up recording the first album in lockdown, and we were in lockdown with another band called Good Habits here from Manchester, and they were a cellist and an accordionist. So that was quite handy because we had an incredible cellist at our disposal as well. So she played on quite a few of the songs, and the accordionist played on one of the bonus tracks that's on the CD that you can purchase. It's not out digitally. And sometimes the melody would come first, or lyric ideas would come first, and then the guitar part, or vice versa. And then I started learning more instruments so that we could add extra instruments in our live performance when we were just performing as a duo. So I learned, well, actually I had to do a music video because my bass player, I had Andy Bain from Fear Patrol, who'd recorded on the track, wasn't able to do the music video. And I thought, how hard can it be? I'll just learn the part and do it myself. And I spent 2 weeks with Purple Fingers learning how to play the part so that I could do that music video. And then I learned the keyboard so that we could add more synth sounds. As I say, as we were expanding into bigger spaces, we wanted to, you know, make a bigger sound. And so then, after all of that, touring in that way, just between the two of us and me, just playing all the other instruments to try and kind of fill that space. When I started recording, then I started recording or writing more on other instruments, like the keyboard instead, and then the guitar would come later. And I started building the tracks with my sound engineer, putting down, because he's a drummer, Andrew Downs, so he would put down kind of a drum idea that I might be hearing in my head or something similar, and then I would build off of that. Or sometimes the drums would come afterwards. And then later on with this particular album that we're about to release, we had Michael Butler, who's currently touring with John Butler Trio. He went in and recorded the drums after the fact, which is not actually how people normally do it. They normally do the drums first, but because that's the way we'd had to do it in lockdown, because it was just Lance and I, even though Lance does play the drums a little bit as well, we'd done it that way before, so it kind of didn't really faze me that we were going to be adding the drums later. And they added something really special to some of the songs, some that we weren't even considering adding drums to. So, yeah, and now I've got all these other musicians, and Ben kind of came in towards the end of the album that we're about to release. So he's added some parts on there. Lance was still around at the beginning of putting that album together, so there's little bits of Lance in there as well. Andy Bain is still on a lot of these tracks playing bass. As I said, Michael Bach is playing the drums. And a lot of the tracks, like Do You, you just played. I pretty much played everything on that song, aside from a few little bits that Module did. So he added a few beats and a guitar to that track. So it's very collaborative, actually, which I think is a good way to go. I do a lot of building the things on my own, but then it's really nice having other people come in with fresh ears and fresh energy to bring, you know, same with the strings and the harpist, which again was an afterthought, adding the harp in. Which my producer thought was a mental thing to do. He was like, you know, this is really something you plan for. You don't just throw a harp in at the end.
I love it.
We did it, and, you know, and it's been awesome. And having her play live, she's also an incredible vocalist. And we've got 5-6-part harmonies happening when we're playing live. So it's really cool.
That is fantastic. When you think about, you know, that you've got people that you can actually play all these different things. It's fantastic. Like we were talking a few weeks ago with a young group of people about, you know, do they ever use AI to create their beats and things, you know, but how it's just so good to still be able to do it the real way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things for me with this band is that I've always wanted it to be real live music, real instruments. And I've seen a lot of pop artists, especially recently, are singing often to backing tracks. So they'll sing to their own self. Mm. And then they'll also have lots of harmony backing tracks as well. And for me, I really want to, you know, I miss the days of a bunch of the musicians, 3 or 4 on stage singing at the same time. I love that.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, the harmonies are a real
there's a real skill too to be able to sing harmonies, you know. So
yeah,
to have you on stage doing it live is so much harder than layering it, singing it one line, and not having to worry about hearing all the other parts and trying to blend and everything. I mean, it's much nicer to listen to live and be fascinated and thrilled when you hear it.
Yes, and anything can happen with live. That's the magic of it to me. You know, things can go wrong, and that's what's so exciting about it. and we're not being auto-tuned and we're not using backing tracks, it's all live. And we did actually get a vocal coach in to help once, because Lance and I, Lance was incredible at harmonies, and so that was just something we naturally did, the two of us, and it was what inspired us to create In the Shallows. And as the years have gone, I've been able to expand on that by getting everyone else in singing. But it hasn't come naturally to everyone. And so we brought the vocal coach in and did a few sessions with her just to make sure, everyone knows where they would fit into things. And then and that's actually what led us to our keyboardist, Anna, who also sings. And, the vocal coach recommended her in her place because the vocal coach sang for us at our hometown show last year when we did the concert film. And she couldn't do all the shows, so she recommended the student of hers who also happened to play the keyboard. And harmonies, that's been her thing her whole life, and she's fantastic. So she's been a really great anchor to have in the band, because she's much more of a natural at it, and so she's able to help guide some of the others a little bit as well. And Shane Hamill, my bass player, he's also pretty good. And it turns out, we've just, as of last week, put a microphone in front of our drummer, because we had to get him to sing on a radio live to air when our guitarist Ben couldn't make it. And he's got an incredible voice as well. So,
and he had been hiding it behind his drums.
Yeah, so he's singing as well now. So now when it's the five piece, all five of us are singing. And when we've got the strings and the harp, our harpist also sings as well. She's got a really beautiful soprano voice. So, it's pretty cool.
Very cool. So tell us, where did it all begin for you? What got you into music to begin with?
So I grew up in a pub in Wales. So my bedroom was above the lounge bar where the musicians used to come and jam. And both my parents were musicians. My dad played piano, and my uncle, my grandfather, my cousins, like lots of people in my family played piano. And my mum played guitar and saxophone. And it was one of those punters that would play beneath my bedroom that gifted my first instrument, which was a violin. And we'd have cover bands come in and we'd do karaoke, and I'd do karaoke with my mum, a lot of which, were tracks that were really strongly focused on harmonies, things like the Mamas and the Papas and stuff like that. And then I went to compete in the Eisteddfod, which is like a Welsh festival that actually the New Zealand Youth Choir just won. They'd just been over in Wales competing and they just won. So, I did that all through school, singing competitively. It's Wales. We sing, we play rugby, and we farm.
Very similar to New Zealand.
Yeah. there's lots of similarities.
And we're going to play one of your new songs, which is part of this tour. So tell us a little bit about Remember Me.
Yeah, so Remember Me was a song that... It actually came to me when I was managing a music shop in Carthy, which, on the note actually of things being hard for everyone, as unfortunately just recently closed down. I just wrote really basic. I'm not, a very good piano player. I can play really basic things enough to get a song out. And that idea came to me there because I used to go in after I dropped my daughter at school for an hour before I would open the shop. And so the song came to me there. And it actually evolved into, believe it or not, a dance track because I'm, just going through a phase of what's possible and I just want to have some fun. So it evolved into a dance track. And then I asked my producer in Canada, who has really incredible skills on the piano. He intuitively makes very beautiful piano pieces. So I gave him the chords and the lyrics and asked him to just create a piano piece for it, because I always felt like it still needed to be heard in that acoustic manner. So we then recorded an acoustic version. I got the piano part and it was beautiful, made me cry. And as I sang it, I cried. And then we added the strings and then the harp and then double bass. And then I wrote the version that, or I made the version that you're about to play now, which was kind of like our radio edit, which again was made just wanting to play with vocal layering. And just, you know, I like to come at songs from different angles and see what's possible with them. And it's quite, I've done it quite a few times with a few of my songs where I've got acoustic versions and big band versions with horns. And in, with this particular song, I released the radio edit plus the acoustic version, of which they're just nothing like one another. It's like two completely different songs, but the lyrics are exactly the same. And I think with the acoustic version, the meaning of it kind of hits home a little bit more than it does in the version that you're about to play. So, yeah, and I kind of wanted that. I felt like that it still needed to be done in that way, because that's kind of how it had started acoustically.
Fabulous. So before we play that, how do our listeners follow you, find out about the tour, get tickets?
Yeah, so you can get tickets from intheshallowsband.com/tour dates. And on our social media, it's pretty much In The Shallows Band everywhere. And then our website is intheshallowsband.com. And yeah, the Auckland show is on the 26th, which is next Saturday. And we're just about to announce our opening act as well from Auckland. Levi Lights On. His name's Michael Levin. And he'll have Mima Wilder with him, his sister. So they're going to be opening for us. And the night before, we're going to be in Taupo for a free show where it's just a five-piece. And after that, we'll be in Palmerston North and wrapping up the tour in Napier. So we're just past halfway of the tour right now.
Fantastic. Well, how would you like to introduce your song here on Kick Arts?
Well, this is our song, Remember Me, and really it's just about wanting to be remembered for the love you gave, despite having realised that maybe things were not quite what you thought they were.
Thank you so much for being here on a Sunday night, and we wish you all the best for your rest of your tour, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your support.
Don't talk anymore, lights trapped in the front door before you left me. Tears running down my face, you offer an embrace before you let me be. Can't tell what's on your mind, always hiding behind what you want me to see. See, I don't know who you are, so how'd you get this far, my baby? From afar.
and that was In the Shallows, Remember Me. So check them out for their tour coming up. Now we're jumping to another part of the country, and joining us now is Kirsty Powell to talk about her latest book. Good evening.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. Now tell me, whereabouts in the country are you calling in from?
I am at Waiapa, which is near Pukekohe.
Right, so I know not too far from where I live. So, yeah, so first of all, tell us a little bit about what is The Strength of the Old Shale all about?
It's a part history, part contemporary novel. It's a sequel to The Strength of Eggshells, which was published in 2020 and won the New Zealand Book Lovers Award for Adult Fiction. So the second book starts 20 years later and moves forward from that point, really with a whole new generation, but some of the old characters as well. But the new book, The Strength of Shale, stands alone. It's a story of two women. One is Belle, who comes from Shetland in the 1850s to Australia, and then comes across to the goldfields to when they discovered gold in Gabriel's Gully in 1861, and is a horse whisperer and looks after the Cobb and Co. coach horses on the goldfield. And it's also the story of a university student based, I'd have to say, pre-COVID, because everything has to be pre or post-COVID, doesn't it? So shall we say 2019? She's a university student who is studying old bones in the archaeology department. And the true story is that Otago University did dig up 24 graves of early... They dug up a forgotten graveyard of 24 graves that were from the very early gold rush. And so she's gone on that dig, and they dig up a woman with long hair and a baby in the same grave. So that's where the novel starts. And it goes backward and forth between those two stories.
And do you think if people were to read this first that they might, what is the hope that they would then go back and read the Eggshells?
Yeah, no, I'm really delighted. A number of people who have read the second novel going back and picking up the first novel, or you can read them in the other order, and then you would understand more about the back history of some of the characters. But the people who just read The Strength of Shale, find it quite fulfilling.
Mm.
They get more backstory if they go back and read the first novel.
Mm. And how long did it take you to write this one?
Well, it's 5 years since I published the first one. But I wasn't writing at all that time. I think when you do something historic, I really had to really look at the history of the Gold Rush and Gabriel's Gully, and the action also moves to Dunstan, which is now Clyde, an amazing historic little town.
That's lovely.
Now beneath a big lake, but it was actually really in the bottom of that lake, in the Clutha River, where they discovered the second lot of gold in that area. And almost overnight, most of the people in Gabriel's Gully set to in the middle of winter and went over the range to get to Dunstan, to get down into that Clutha River in the middle of winter, would you believe, to really, try and sluice and find the gold there.
Now, anyone that maybe doesn't know Otago, the middle of winter in Otago, I mean, like many of the listeners know, I was down there in Queenstown only, a few weeks back, and we were waking up in the morning to, we had one morning that was -6 in the morning. So, in the winter to be in sluicing and water, you can imagine how cold the water would have been.
Yeah, and living in tents. to start with no firewood, because they very quickly used up any, you know, supply of firewood in that area. So, no, they were very tough, resilient people, you know, who've come from all over the world to be in that environment. Yeah.
So have you got your next book underway?
Yes, I think I'll write a more contemporary story. I've always done several things at once. I'm also working on a biography project. The first harbour master at Auckland, his name was Captain David Ruff, and no one's really written a definitive history. So I'm actually at the stage of seeing what extra information I can find about him. But I hope to publish another novel which will be contemporary and is not another one in this series. So this will just be a pigeon pair, really, the strength of eggshells and the strength of old shell. Some listeners may be interested to know that the strength of eggshells, again, it's part contemporary and part history. And the history in that one is about the soldier settlement. It was a rural farming settlement after the First World War above the Bridge to Nowhere off the Whanganui River, which was another very tough rural environment for people to settle, and another very interesting part of New Zealand if you ever want to take a jet boat ride and from Papariki and go up and explore that area.
So you've clearly seen a lot of Aotearoa.
Yeah, no, I have. I've done a lot of, both stories involve quite a lot of motorcycling. I've actually done a lot of motorcycling, both in New Zealand and around the world. So back roads are, you know, of interest to me. And I also grew up in a rural location in the Wairarapa, Wairarapa, east of Ekitahuna. So if anyone enjoys learning more about the rural history of New Zealand, I'm sure you would enjoy that. The contemporary story, as well as for the strength of old shell, it's partially set with the university student Ariel in Dunedin, but she comes from Whangamomona, which is another really interesting rural part of New Zealand. Have you been to Whangamomona?
No, well, whereabouts is it? Like, it doesn't ring bells with me, but I am a Dunedin girl myself, and Central Otago was a holiday place, as was Southland.
Ah, no, but this is in the North Island.
Oh.
She's actually a North Islander. So Whangamomona is between Taumarunui and Stratford on a back road. And they're quite a rebellious little village. They've set themselves up as a republic because it's just a historical thing. They had to pay rates to a council which, you know, they had nothing to do with. It's just how the watersheds off their farms work. So they set up a wee republic, and it's a really iconic place, and really the centre of it is the Whangamomona Hotel, which is a wonderful place to visit. And in my stories, I often use as secondary characters real people. And in The Strength of Eggshells, you get to meet Vicky and Richard Pratt, who are real people, who really are the publicans at the hotel there. Yeah, so it's quite fun to actually do that.
Mm. Yeah, fantastic. So come in and look at what's sitting on your nightstand, what kind of books interest you to read?
Well, I read a lot. At night, after the lights are up, I read quite a lot on my Kindle. And actually, I've just gone back. I read quite recently Tim Winton's Juice, which is futuristic, and it's about Australia in an environmental crisis, and it's a really very grim and grim read, really. Are you familiar with Tim Winton?
No.
He's written before. He's from Perth, and he often writes about Perth, but I mean, this is futuristic in a time in Australia where people are pretty much living underground. And that whole thought inspired me to go back and look at 1984 by George Orwell, which really, it's quite interesting. I mean, when 1984 came around and we all reread George Orwell's book, it just seemed we were living in quite a benign space compared to where we are now.
Mm.
And rereading it now, it's really quite interesting with what we're starting to see changing in the world. It feels a lot more real than it did in 1984. Mm. I think you just named it to the wrong decade, really.
So tell us, where can people find more about your writing and this particular book?
Well, Bateman's are putting it into all good bookstores, and I understand that Whitcoles are it was launched in June, so all good bookshops, you should be able to get it or order it. We've had good sales and good reviews, and I've had some fantastic book launches, or you know, in rather mm-hmm. interesting places like Whangamomina and Lawrence, and Yeah, a shout out to the two places I launched it in Auckland. Dear Reader in Grey Lynn is a really lovely little bookshop there with an incredible range of books. And also Paper Plus in Pukekohe.
Lovely.
A shout out to them, which was great. We had a great book launch there as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being available to talk about your book this evening, Kirsty, on this Sunday night, later at night. And we look forward to maybe hearing from you again in the future next time something comes out.
Wow, excellent. And thank you for taking the time to ring me.
No worries. Thank you so much. Now we're going to take a quick music break with our friend Captain Festus McBoyle has got a new track out. It's a short one. It's called Mr. Cheese, If You Please.
Little something about Mr. Cheese. I tell you what, if he touches smart cheese, I'll cut his bleeding tail off.
He's a rat, he's a rat, he's a big dirty rat. He's a man. And he goes through the bins to fill his poo with poo when he can. He's got teeth, two front teeth, those two teeth, they can chew through a tree. But he's our friend, he's our friend to both me and Lucy. And again, keep it going. He's a rat, he's a big dirty rat, he's a man. And he goes through the bins to fill his book with food when he can. Oh, he's got teeth, two front teeth, those two teeth I could chew through a tree. Oh, but he's our friend, he's our friend, he's our friend to both me and Lucy. Oh, he's a rat, he's a big dirty rat, he's a man. And he goes through the bins to fill his pocket with food when he can. He's got teeth, two front teeth, those two teeth, I could chew through a tree. Oh, buddy, he's our friend, he's a friend, he's our friend, about me and Lucy. We dog him. He's a rat, he's a big dirty rat. Yeah, he's a man.
But he identifies as a rat, and who are we to judge? I mean, come on, move on, geezer. Next song.
Oh, we've got to love a little bit of the captain. He always keeps us on our toes. He gave me a wee bit of a fright then when all the voices came in, because I'm in the studio by myself and suddenly there was a whole lot more voices. But thank you, Captain, for that. Now, obviously, we're keen to hear from you. What are you doing in the arts? Anywhere around Aotearoa? We're keen. We can either phone you or you can come into the studio. Do flick us an email at info@kickarts.org.nz. We've got some spaces coming up. And as I said earlier in the show, we would love to hear from you if you've got any new music that we can share. Now, the theatre list has come in for this week, and I was just having a quick look. Fizz, Bold Colours, Bolder Comedy from Mischief Company. Think Whose Line Is It Anyway? But live, local and bursting with mischief. Now, this sounds like a great one. From the crew behind Potluck, Fizz is four nights of improv chaos fueled by your wildest suggestions. Fast games, big characters and ridiculous fun. They're on Friday nights until the 1st of August at the Vic in Devonport. Check out tickets at thevic.co.nz. So get along to that. And if you're not on the theatre list, do sign up for it. That's the Auckland Theatre List to find out what's happening. And if you've got anything to list there, contact them at hello@thetheatrelist.com. Now, we've run out of time for tonight. It was great, all our calls around the country. And we're going out this evening with T. Matatini and Corella with We Belong, the official music video, which features L.A.B. So make sure you go out there and kick some ass.
All our stories told and make us who we are. And it's a feeling running through you. Will you come and share with me? Hearing all my thoughts you need. Cause we're right where we belong. Right where we belong. Right where we belong. Right where we belong. See, I'm ready. The Matatini is calling. Calling me closer to you.
brush your teeth and don't forget to go to sleep. We'll be going live, same time under the stars, saying blah, 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 blah. Let's go kick some R.